I try to tell all my clients, if you can hang on to it, you know, even through the tough period, hang on to it. I mean, it's maybe you're bleeding, but just because you're bleeding on a property doesn't mean you're bleeding in life, right? Maybe your salaries can help you support, because I believe that, you know, the numbers that I was seeing back then, the values were so low, it just didn't make any sense because it was cheaper than labor, material, and cost of the land. So it just didn't add up, but it required a lot of patience. And those who hang on to them did okay, right? It just took 7 to 10 years, depending where, to go over that major hole.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am very excited to introduce our guest for the day, Danny Bate Orr. Danny, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Much appreciated. I enjoy listening to some of your previous episodes, so good job.
Thank you. Really appreciate that. Well, I'm excited to share your story and your knowledge and expertise with our listener base. So everyone, Danny, with over 18 years of experience in investing in real estate, he uses his knowledge and experience to secure financial growth for beginners to experienced investors. So I'm really excited to have Danny give us more of a bit about his background. Why don't you start us out with telling us a little bit about how you got into this space and why?
You may detect a tiny little accent in my voice. I'm originally from Israel. I was born in Israel and I grew up just outside of Tel Aviv and went to the, you know, spent 3 years in the Israeli military as a mandatory service, although I enjoyed my mandatory service in the special forces. It was a tough, but very challenging and very teaching in many ways. And when I, after I got my engineering degree back in, you know, in Israel, I started my job in a high-tech company, and I was actually paid quite well for a beginner, like a starting position, so to speak. And I very quickly realized that something doesn't make sense. Something doesn't add up. Here I am, young guy, 25-ish at the time, making a good salary, but working long hours. It wasn't a startup, but it was a little bit of a startup hours. And that's also a very much engraved in the Israeli high-tech culture, the long hours. And after about a year, I asked myself, where is this heading? Am I going to be following the same footsteps of my parents, my uncles, my parents' friends, my older cousins, you know, all working long hours, hardworking, good work ethics. And 15, 20 years later, what do they have for all those long hours and missing on family and events and stuff like that? A condo with a mortgage. And I look at this kind of, I'm looking into the future. I'm saying something doesn't add up here. I am not willing to, I don't know what the answer is. I didn't know what the answer is. I knew that I don't know how to make, you know, some people are really good with like finding ways how to get rich quick kind of a scheme. I still didn't figure it out 20 years later. So I didn't have the answer back then. I still don't have the answer. And I realized that this is not an avenue I want to follow because I don't know how to do that. But I knew that I'm not willing to accept my my fortune cookie, so to speak. And I knew that this path, I am not okay with it. I don't know what is, but I'm not okay with the default. So yeah, so I took about a year, maybe close to 2 years, and started educating myself. First of all, I felt that I am real life financial. I have an engineering degree. I studied economics, and I still feel real life economics, real life finances illiterate. So I took 2 years and I taught myself many things about retirement accounts and investing different things, like in the simple thing, or the things that we have like close to us. And from there, it's kind of escalated And then when I saved up a little bit more, a little money, I said, okay, what's now? Where can I invest naturally or maybe not naturally? I started investing in stocks and options, but I wasn't pleased with the risk rewards. I was doing okay. Someone else was doing it for me, like a portfolio manager, but I didn't like the combination of risk rewards that I was getting. And it, even when I did well, it took my, I don't know, it added another $1,000 to my bank account a year later, or 2,000 or even 5,000, which is amazing year, right? On the little amount that I was working, but it wasn't an impactful on my life. And it was very risky too. And I started looking for something else. While I was searching, like on a quest, on a serious quest, I kind of got exposed or learned about US real estate. And I decided that this is a really good fit for lower risk, high rewards, and fits the model of long-term, like, you know, maybe get rich slow kind of a scheme and not quick kind of a scheme. And I bought my first house in 2002 in a little town called,
Can I just pause you for a second before you continue on with your story, which I'm loving. So you said that you were investing in, I guess, was it like you're investing in the stock market, someone was managing your portfolio for you. Was that, so why did you view that to be risky?
Because I shifted most of my investments not to stocks, but to options.
Okay.
And options can be really tricky.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can lose your entire investment, assuming you're not leveraging, you can lose your entire investment. So it's a hedging kind of a method. And that was on the option side. It was high risk. The rewards were good. And on the stocks, in the stock market, for me, it always felt this. And this is my like world of values. Like I'm giving trust in 5, 6, 7, 10, 20 guys or gals in a company that they're going to dictate how what they will have an effect on the stock, basically on the stock value. And it just didn't make sense to me, like a small group of people having so much influence on a stock, which I know they want it to be in a good way. I never thought it was coming from a negative way, but just didn't make sense. Like 20 people, 10 people of a company are, responsible for the results, and I have to trust them to do their job properly. And we know that many of them, like Apple and Amazon, do really good job, and many or some don't. So it felt like not really a good fit for me for the risk rewards that I was looking for when I have all this control in putting my faith on someone else, some corporate executive. And it, obviously it's working for, the entire economic system is based on that. But for me, in my simple circle of influence, my world, it just didn't add up. I don't know. I'm still hesitant about that. It's not really sitting well with me. Let's just put it this way. Just my belief system.
Okay. Yes. And then, when you say you found US real estate, what is it about US real estate that you found to be attractive as, because you're obviously from another country. What is appealing about US real estate?
So the first thing that I got really kind of caught my attention is the rent purchase price ratio, which was much better than what I was able to see happening in Israel. So that was the first like aha moment. And then the second aha moment, which I still to this day, I'm looking at it as an aha moment, is what I call the mortgage miracle. So a lot of people who live in this country take it for granted. You get a mortgage, a nice mortgage, residential mortgage, which is not indexed, not pegged to the cost of living, which is amazing. And this is how it is, right? No, it's not. In most countries around the world, your mortgage is pegged to the cost of living, is pegged to the, is indexed. And this is how money works in the real world. Money is, invested, is pegged to some index. In this country, you get a mortgage, you lock your payments, and if you don't do anything for the next, let's say, 30 years, you're just, your monthly payment is going to be the same. So the rent may go through the roof. Let's say in 10 years, your rent is 5 times more, your mortgage is always still the same amount. And that's crazy. Where do you get that? I mean, it's not normal economics. And this is a gift for us, the borrowers, where if we really get it.
I'm not so familiar with this. So for me and the other listeners, so if you were to get a mortgage in Israel, then it would increase with the cost of living, the payment?
it's pegged, it's indexed. So that means if the cost of living went up, you are now paying, let's say on the first month, your monthly payment is $1,000, right?
Yeah.
And the cost of living went up and the index went up. So now you're paying, you know, $1,050. It's not a lot. 5 years later, cost of living went up. Now you're paying $1,300, right?
Yeah.
By the way, it has the same negative way where, let's say the cost of living went down and all of a sudden you 5 years later, you're paying $1,250 and then it went down and now it's $1,175, right? So it goes with its index, right? So it goes up and down. And as long as the index goes up over time, you're paying more, right? Which actually makes sense financially, not in the United States, not on those amazing residential. That's why I call it the mortgage miracle. The index can go up. Listen, this year, right? This crazy year of COVID, consumer index went, I think, like 5% is right now on 5% in the past year, which is quite high for a healthy economy. It's not extremely high, but the mortgage that we took a year ago is still the same. We are still paying the same, whatever amount we're paying, $500, $1,000. It didn't go up. It didn't keep up. In another country, I would be paying now 5% more. Why? Because the cost of living went up, which, so this is amazing. I mean, you have to be, I think, either a foreigner to appreciate it or to be reminded of it, because we are just, well, other countries are actually indexing and pegging the cost of living. It's, you know, yes, they do in most cases. So that was another big aha moment. You see how I, you know, I've been talking about it for 18 years and I still get excited over this point because it's very abstract concept. It's hard to internalize it. But if you get it, let's just look over a long term. If you start with a monthly payment, you know, the best way to explain it is this. The months for, let's say on the first month you buy the house, your mortgage payments are $500 and the rent is $1,000, right? Just these simple numbers. So that means 50% of the rent goes to cover your what's debt service, right? The mortgage payments. Now fast forward, you know, 10 years, the rent is $3,000. The mortgage payment is now still $500, which is a fraction, right? And it's now what, 25% or 20% of the rent. That's amazing, right? Not to mention that your principal buys you less, right? So you borrow. So that's unbelievable. Yeah, I know. I think enough about that. I'm probably going to lose people from the...
No. That's great. I mean, it's great to get your perspective because we do kind of, I think, take that for granted a bit here in the United States. Okay. So you bought your first property when?
2002.
Okay. And so you eventually relocated to the US.
Not immediately. I've done everything remotely. Sight unseen, I bought a new construction. So that means I bought a lot and they started building on it. It was ready at the beginning of 2003. So closing took place in 2003. And I actually had a trip somewhere probably the beginning of 2003. And I went to see the house, or maybe it was still under construction at the beginning of 2003, because I was just curious to see what I'm buying, because everything until that point was on paper. You know, in 2003, Google was a startup. Google Maps was not around. Zillow was not around, right? A lot of the public records, which we take for granted, was not around. And this was not just buying another property in a neighboring state. I was buying a completely different time zone, different language, different rules, different culture. You know, all those gaps, I had to overcome all those gaps. And technology was not as supportive as today with closing all those gaps. But I don't know. It made more sense than buying locally, I guess, at the time. Not, I guess. I mean, that investment was amazing. It's exceeded by far what I was even planning. I had my very kind of limited expectations and it did much better than I expected and fueled more investments.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, awesome. So you were purchasing these properties from Israel?
I did two other small investments in Florida before I moved in 2004. In 2004, obviously, I'm getting all excited about this real estate thing and I told myself, in order to really immerse myself into real estate, you know, in a professional way, in order to benefit myself, I have to do it. So I moved over and I started doing real estate full time, working with investors, buying more for myself, helping others. And that's kind of immersed me into real estate. So it wasn't, I wanted to grind in order to become a professional about it. And I didn't want to just okay, it's a nice house. That's the way I wanted to do it back then. And in since 2004, I've kind of moved from working for high tech, doing real estate, helping others on a larger scale.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Okay, so you've been doing this a long time, which is awesome. What is some advice you would give to people who are looking to get started in real estate investing?
Well, first of all, I would say if they're looking to start in real estate, because real estate is a large store of options, right? There's many ways how to dissect it. Commercial, residential, long-term, short-term, Airbnb, whatever, or short, flipping, whatever. So notes, there's so many options here. It can be actually confusing. I think that one of the things that I see a lot of investors are not doing, they're actually just jumping into the water, which is fine. But they're, even when you jump into the water, which is great, at one point I would suggest go to the side, and sit down for 5 minutes with yourself and just ask yourself a few difficult questions, but critically important, that will help you create some clarity about what kind of real estate you should be doing. It's not necessarily what I should be doing, but what you should be doing, right? So things like, can I get a mortgage, right? Really trivial, but some people don't even, they start and then, oh, I need a mortgage. How much time do I have, for it? Do I have a lot of time or very limited? How much confidence or lack of confidence do I have? Should I be active or passive? So there's like a series of few, maybe 10 questions that I sometimes share with people. So just ask yourself, use those kind of self-assessment questions that will help you determine which avenue is good for you. Because once you determine which avenue is good for you, then you would probably be able to pursue it in a more focused way. Otherwise, you'll be distracted and may not do anything. Because here's what I see, or what I used to see before COVID. Someone would go to a meetup or some investment club, and this time there's someone who talks about, self-storage, and this is exciting, and this is the best thing. And for the following week, they pursue that self-storage concept or niche. And a week later, they go to another club, but this time there's a mobile park, expert. And now they're shifting all over to the mobile park person investing, which makes perfect sense, right? They both do. And then on the third week, this time there's some guy with an accent talks about single-family homes out of state, and that makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
Really distracting. So I sometimes tell people, stop going to those clubs. I mean, I hopefully the club organizer won't hit me. Go study, expose, sponge yourself. At one point, say stop, and now decide what is the right way for you. And by the way, just because you start today with self-storage doesn't mean in 6 months, a year, 2 years, you cannot shift to another avenue of flipping, whatever, right? It's okay, but I think time and focus is the biggest challenge. And having all those options, it's not always helpful. It actually makes it, in Israel, it's very simple. You either buy for a rent or buy for a rent.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's like what you're saying is such an important point. You clearly work with real estate investors who are getting started in the space. And this is something that you're seeing over and over again, it sounds like, right? Like what people need is time and focus. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So what would you say some of the other sort of common issues are that you're seeing with your students?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, lux-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Once they come to my world of real estate, I make sure they know how to evaluate, like work quality, and how to analyze a property in order to make good decisions, right? I, to this day, look at people who post online some example or potential investment properties. And I'm like, wait, really, your HOA is not a real thing? You don't include it in your expenses, or vacancy is not a real thing and you don't include that in your expenses, or stuff that I'm like blown away that they're so superficially analyzing. And I'm like, that's too bad. You're gonna make some mistakes. I mean, you could make smarter, better decisions. So know how to analyze well. And the other thing that I did first work with my investors, let's create a set of criteria for you. And a set of criteria is very important to help them decide or determine if a specific property meets that criteria, exceeds or below. Because if it's below, move on. It's okay. Just move on. And if it exceeds, definitely, take a charge and move forward with it. And if it's kind of borderline or you're not sure, let's evaluate what's going on here. Maybe we're missing something that will make it, beneficial for you. So those little kind of tools help all of us stay focused again and make smart decisions. Because this is how when we make smart decisions now, it will benefit us down the road in a year and in 10 years. So it's all about, making those smart decisions. It's easier said than done, right? I mean, it sounds like a huge statement, but the way I look at how we make those decisions, I say when one of my clients buys one house, there is a series of 25 decisions, which I call each one of them a medium-sized decision. Not every one of those decisions is horrific, that, it's a major decision. And none of them is insignificant. It's a medium size in importance. And when you make 25 medium size in importance-wise decisions, and let's say out of the 25, even five do not materialize to be, how we expect them, right? This is real estate. This is life. We don't always know the future, of course. So even if five out of 25 did not materialize to be exactly how we expected, and they, let's say, fail. First of all, it doesn't mean they catastrophically fail, but let's just say they do not perform as we expected. You still have 20 other decisions you made along the way that are holding this investment. So it's like each one of those decisions, like a post or a foundation pole that our investment sits on. And even if 5 out of 20 are not okay, or they just didn't materialize correctly as we expected, you still have 20 others holding the investment. So I can let 5 fail. And that's okay. And 20 will support my decision. That's how I look at the broader decision process of those of every single property.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very interesting approach. Do you have some examples of what those 25 medium decisions are?
Yeah, of course. So it starts with which metro to go to.
Okay.
How do we pick a metro? Not just which metro. There's a recipe I follow how to choose a US metro. What has to happen in that metro goes into how do we pick and select and vet the local teams such as property managers and realtors. So it's kind of, it's every one of those lines is just like a title, but it has hours of work behind it. And then how do we analyze a property? Which kind of properties we buy? So let me explain a very good example of how it works in the negative way. So when I'm in Israel, I always get invited to speak. I was just there for 5 weeks during the summer. And every time in Israel, the most popular product for real estate investors is the $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 homes in different parts of the country. Like most people who are listening now know that $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 homes around the country are usually old, in not the best part of town, with a paycheck to paycheck kind of tenants, and it could work and it could maybe not always work. And what happened next is they buy one, two, three of those properties, typically cash. And then a few months later, they are certain that the property management company that manages the properties are crooks and they're cheating them. Why? Because that's what we all know, right? All property managers are bad people, which is obviously we know it's not true, but for them, it's exactly, that's the way they perceive it. Now, and I tell them, the fact that you bought an old house in a challenging area that has higher maintenance, has harder time keeping tenants, that's all recipe for noise in the system, for things to fail. And then you put the blame on the property manager. Well, guess what? Let me buy a nice house in a good school district, something that is 20, 30, 40 years old, not 100 years old, and make sure you carefully pick the property management company you completely turn around this situation, and you will still have noise in the system, but not as much. You're still going to have vacancy and repairs and maintenance and miscommunication, but not as much. Those are the type of things that it's very trivial. On paper, the property looks amazing. $80,000, rents for $1,000 a month. Wow, it's a cash flow bonanza, right? In reality, probably 70% or 80% of those properties are not going to actually live up to that cash flow bonanza in the description. You know, maybe you're lucky. You got a nice tenant, actually, and the house is not breaking, you know, every other month. I call it luck. But that's not planned. That's speculation. It may work.
For sure. Okay. So here's another question for you, Danny. So you lived through, as a real estate investor, the 2008 crash. What was that like for you? Did you have any hardships? Did anything go
Absolutely.
Wrong?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Tell us all about that. Sure.
All right. So I entered the 2008 crash with probably multiple properties of my own and many, many, many more with my investors. That was a tough period. Let's just put it this. So definitely personal hardship. You know, when I speak to people who went through that period and they say, hey, no problem. I'm like, I don't believe you. So definitely a hardship on a personal level. I took an oath with myself and I said, every one of my investors that will call me for support during that era, during that period, I will definitely pick up the phone and answer, because I've seen people around me that kind of vanished or put their head in the sand and waited for the storm to go over. And I said, I'm not going to do that. This is, for me, this is a true person who helps his clients, is someone who's there in the tough times, not just when it's easy. And even back then I had experience, but I wasn't, you know, I was probably 4 years of experience, multiple properties. So I wasn't a beginner, but the crash taught me a lot about real estate. I had to dive into the nitty gritty of different aspects of investing. It wasn't even an option in order to get out of situations. And then I made sure I shared that everything I learned with my clientele to help them. Maybe something that I have found can benefit someone else. And the one thing that you can remember is I try to tell all my clients, if you can hang on to it, you know, even through the tough period, hang on to it. I mean, it's maybe you're bleeding, but just because you're bleeding on a property doesn't mean you're bleeding in life, right? Maybe your salaries can help you support, because I believe that, you know, the numbers that I was seeing back then, the values were so low, it just didn't make any sense, because it was cheaper than labor, material, and cost of the land. So it just didn't add up, but it required a lot of patience. And those who hang on to them did okay, right? It just took 7 to 10 years, depending where, to go over that major hole.
And were these like single family houses or multi-family?
Psychological bleeding. Well, actually not exactly. So there's two things here. The interesting thing that I experienced on a personal level, and I could see it with others, is that while the values were dropping, the rents went up, vacancies went down. So financially, the cash flow should have been better. The problem leading into this period is that we bought a lot of properties with a maximum leverage, knowing from day one it's going to be in a negative cash flow. So when you have, I don't know, 20 properties, each one is...
And are these single family houses?
Mostly single family, maybe some condos, but mostly single family. And when you have, let's say, 20 properties, and each one is, in a normal day, generates $200-$300, you know, in a negative cash flow every month, you know, times 20, right? That's what, $4,000-$5,000 every month you're spending, right? You have to bring from your income. Now, if your income is stable and safe and you can afford to bring $5,000 a month, then you're not bleeding. You can stop the bleeding. Actually, there's some tax benefits there. But if your income went down and you can't bring this $5,000 or whatever in, then that's a problem. You're unable to close the gap. And that's the challenge. So it really depends on the situation. But we were going into this crash phase with significant negative cash flow. The other thing is psychological, which is a really important impact, because if you're myself, I bought a house in Orlando for $190,000 in September of 2005, right? $190,000, $188,000 exactly. It went down in 2009 all the way to $84,500. So it's half-ish.
Yeah.
Right? Now, going to sleep at night, it's not a comfortable feeling. You feel like you failed. You don't know anything. What are you doing? You're doubting yourself big time, right? So the confidence takes a hit because the value, like, you know, dropped significantly. But then when you kind of take the thinking few steps forward, you say, wait, what's really going on here? Number one, did you buy this house to sell it a year or two later? Long term, okay, be patient. Number two, did you make a bad decision when buying this house? Is this a horrible house in many terms? Not at all. It's actually a really good house, a good location, city, metro, you know, within Orlando. Is it rented? Yes, actually very well. The rent went up. So all of a sudden, this house that the feeling is not good, but when you run the numbers, it's actually okay. And then I told myself, be patient. And I told my clients, be patient. If you're gonna be patient, just let's ride it for the next 10 years, right? This house today is somewhere 275, 300-ish. I don't know exactly, right? Depending what Zillow says on a certain day. But it's around that number, which is great, right? It's not bad. It's been vacant, you know, in all those 15 years that I've owned it, 16 years, combined, it was vacant for 4 months.
Okay, so that's awesome. So what would you say you would do going forward? Like, would you have would you continue to buy negative cash flowing properties? Or what did you learn about leverage? What would you do differently this time around?
So since the crash, when I came out of the crash on the other side, I redesigned my systems, my processes, and a couple of things were very apparent. Number one, always buy with a cash flow. I don't need a lot of cash flow, but $200-$300 a month, realistically, not, fluffed in any way or hyped in any way, is a good starting point, right? It's a buffer. So does it mean I may buy less number of properties? Absolutely, but that's okay. Because what I want all my clients to have is houses that are financially independent of them, right? So if they lose their job, the house is not, you know, they don't have to carry that house on them. So that was number one, is to properly analyze properties financially and to make sure we have the cash flow to be self-sustained or independent property. The second thing is, all the decisions, remember, I go back to the 25 decisions I talk about, all the decisions of where to buy, what to buy, etc., starts at a very important core point or starting point. The next big crash is coming. That's the way I've been waiting for a crash for more than 10 years. I've been preparing and waiting for a crash for more than 10 years, right? And I thought we finally got it a year ago. Apparently, we didn't. But when COVID hit, I felt that my recipe or my investment formula is going, at least in the first few months of April, March, April, May, and June of 2020, I felt that my investment formula is going through a stress test. And I was actually happy to put my formula through a stress test because I've been waiting for it. I've been waiting for it for a long time. And I know it sounds like, you know, like a cliche to say it right now, but I've been talking about it for more than 10 years with people, and the stress test survived very well. We went down from, you know, at the first few months from a 97 collection on rents to 96 or 95 and a half. That's insignificant. Some of my friends back then would tell me, oh, we're doing good. We are at 70% collection. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to bash them that they're at 70 and I'm at 95 and a half. I'm okay with 95 and a half. There's no difference. So that was really pleasing to see. I was planning for it, preparing for it. When that window of time came and the stress test kind of made our formula survive well, I was blown away because you can still plan for something and it doesn't mean it will materialize or happen. When it's actually happening, oh my God, I was like, I like that a lot. Of course, yeah, thank you. But, you know, we had problems, there were issues, but the number of properties that we were having issues relative to the number of properties we have in the ecosystem is almost zero. I mean, it's like 10, 12 properties had some issues. I'm one of them, by the way, and I'm not happy for any of us who are having those issues, but you know what? I'll take it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, that's great. I think those are some great lessons learned. So are you doing syndications right now, Danny?
I used to, not anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
I did multiple syndications over the years, primarily for flipping houses. I anywhere from one syndication for one house to one to or for example, or multiple syndications, long-term multiple properties under one entity. I just realized that the hustle of herding cats, I call it, is that's my biggest challenge. That's the one, if there's one thing I feel that I haven't kind of fine-tuned, is not the properties, is not the investment, is actually the hustle of the all those little questions and all those little criticisms. And I'm like, I take every little criticism to heart. So when someone says, question my, you know, my integrity, I lose sleep at night because there's no reason for it, but it kind of puts me in like, why is he saying that? Like, so the problem lies with me. But until I figure out how to not take it to heart, which I still haven't, I guess I don't have the thick skin, or a different way mechanism to run it, that's what's kind of been my challenge. Not the core investing. That's, I probably almost perfected that.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, we've had just a ton of great insights, and thank you so much for sharing so many of your stories and, you know, insights into this business. Really appreciate it, Danny. Could you please share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share?
Yeah, for sure. And thank you for letting me do that. So my web handle or web ID is the name of my company, which is Simply Do It. Simply Do It. If you write Simply Do It or Simply Do It Real Estate, you'll come to my website, which is simplydoit.net, or Twitter and on Facebook, pretty much if YouTube. I have a podcast as well that I just talk about different topics that I run into, you know, with questions from clients throughout the week. I should probably go start doing some interviews as well. I haven't done that. Yeah. So Simply Do It. The easiest way probably to remember, find us online, you send a message, we'll get in touch with you if someone is interested.
Awesome. Well, I hope you all take some time to check out Danny's website. Danny, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.